Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is meant for English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, Alice Bryant tells us about the many different ways language students can use Google Translate. Next, John Russell and Pete Musto bring us another Everyday Grammar report. This week's episode centers on the adverb always. Finally, we continue with our American history series. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
As smartphones continue to get smarter, we can only expect Google Translate to stay one step ahead. Over 200 million people around the world now depend on the free application every day. And yet, many users do not know about some of its most exciting features. We are here today to help change that. Let's start with your smartphone camera. By pointing the camera at an object with words on it, you can translate those words into many languages. This feature will translate the words from whatever the camera sees, whether it is a street sign, restaurant menu, or even handwriting. Simply touch the camera button on the app and point the device at whatever you'd like. This may be one of the app's most striking features, although it usually works better with printed words than handwriting. Google Translate now also translates whatever it hears. If your electronic device has a microphone, you can talk directly into it and the program will quickly begin translating several sentences. But it does not like when a speaker stops in the middle of a thought. This feature works on both the smartphone app and the website. You can even play pre-recorded audio or video close to the microphone, and Google Translate will work fairly well. To use this feature, just touch the microphone image. We reported recently on Google Pixel Buds, which also translates spoken language.
If you have ever been to another country, you know how unpredictable a cellular or wireless connection can be. Google Translate now offers users the ability to download a whole language for future use offline. To activate the service, you must first download the language with a Wi-Fi or cellular connection, so it's probably best to do this before traveling. The download for each language can be about 25 or 30 megabytes in size. So look at the data plan for your device if you expect to download without Wi-Fi. To find the offline translation feature, just hit the settings image in the app. Our next feature seems like it was created just for fun. You can now write words by hand directly onto the screen of your smartphone in the Google Translate app. The app will then translate the word or expression. This feature works well, even with unclear handwriting. We tested it by writing words unclearly in a few languages. Each time, the translation was correct. Another wonderful feature is the phrase book. You can save and reuse your most commonly searched words and expressions in the phrase book. To do this on your smartphone or computer, simply touch the star image. On a computer, the phrase book also lets you sort the saved terms by language, which is useful if you are using or learning several languages. The phrase book can even be an excellent tool for examining sentence structure. You can use it to compare the structure of sentences in two languages. Language learners all over the world will welcome the next feature. Everyone knows how difficult it can be to understand a foreign language when it is spoken too quickly. But did you know that Google Translate will slow down the speed of its speech at your request? Simply touch the listen image twice to hear the translation at the slower speed.
You will never feel too distant from friends or family overseas with the next feature. If your smartphone uses the Android operating system, you are in luck. Google Translate will perform translations directly in WhatsApp and Facebook Messenger. No need to copy and paste the text from those apps into Google Translate. Finally, you can help to improve the translation quality of Google Translate for users around the world. There are two ways to do this. Suggest a change for individual translations or join the Translate community. Suggesting a change is easy. Just type or paste in words or phrases on the device as you normally would. If the translation looks problematic, simply suggest an edit inside the translated box. The second way is to join the Translate community. Go to translate.google.com/community and sign into your Google account. Then, you can either review the quality of phrases that have already been translated, or translate words and phrases into your chosen language. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
The film Casablanca is one of the most famous American movies of all time. At the end of the film, the actor Humphrey Bogart says a heartbreaking farewell to the woman he loves.
But what about us?
We'll always have Paris.
Besides affecting one's emotions, this movie scene can teach you a lot about English grammar. It can show you how English speakers use adverbs in a sentence. In our program today, we explore a single word, always. We will discover why Bogart said his famous line the way he did.
Adverbs are words that change the meaning of a verb, adjective, or sentence. They are often used to show time, place, or a way of doing things. Adverbs are often movable. They can appear at the beginning, middle, or end of a sentence. Consider these examples.
Occasionally, I eat seafood. I occasionally eat seafood. I eat seafood occasionally.
In this example, the adverb occasionally appears in three different places in the sentence. The placement of the adverb does not change the meaning. All three sentences have the same meaning. Most English speakers would not think it strange if you used any one of these sentences.
What about the adverb always? In general, the adverb always is not as movable as other kinds of adverbs, like the word occasionally. You will not often hear an English speaker use always at the beginning or the end of a sentence. Most often, you will hear always in the middle of the sentence, before the verb it is modifying. In some cases, you might hear it at the beginning of a sentence, when giving an order or command, for example. Or you might hear it at the end of a sentence, but usually only in an artistic setting, a poetry reading or a musical performance, for example. But the central point is this. In speaking and in writing, always does not move its position as often as other adverbs. So, if you were to take our example sentence, "I eat seafood," and use the adverb always, you could say, "I always eat seafood." Always generally is found after be verbs and auxiliary verbs, but before other verbs. You will find this structure in many popular films. Consider this famous line from A Streetcar Named Desire.
Whoever you are, I've always depended on the kindness of strangers.
In the example, always appears after the auxiliary verb have and just before the main verb depended. This same idea is true of Bogart's famous line from Casablanca, "We'll always have Paris." "We'll" is a short way to say "we will." Always appears after the auxiliary verb will and before the main verb have.
You might think that our story about the word always ends here, but it does not. English speakers can also change the meaning of always. When you hear or read the adverb always in its usual position, before the verb it is modifying, it generally has the meaning of habitually. However, sometimes you will hear English speakers emphasize the word always. In this case, the meaning of the sentence has changed. Think back to our example sentence.
I always eat seafood.
This sentence means that you usually eat seafood, perhaps when you go to a restaurant. If the speaker says,
I always eat seafood,
with the emphasis on the word always, then the speaker is expressing annoyance. Perhaps the speaker is angry that another person, a close friend, for example, did not remember they like to eat seafood when they go out to dinner. Here is another example. You hear a child say,
My father always works late on Thursdays.
This sentence uses the adverb always to express a habitual or common action. However, if you hear the child say,
My dad always works late on Thursdays,
then you know that the child is unhappy with the father's work schedule.
So now you know that if Bogart had used the emphasized always in the film Casablanca, the ending of the film would have been very different. The next time you are listening or speaking, try to pay attention to the placement of the word always. Then, try to identify if it is emphasized or not. This will help you understand the speaker's feelings. Remember, English does not always communicate meaning through grammar. Emphasis plays an important role in showing the meaning of a sentence. With practice, you too will be able to use always like a native speaker. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm John Russell.
Today on our American History series, we tell the story of a clash of cultures and beliefs. Steve Ember looks at the early history of relations between European settlers in North America and the native groups that had lived there for thousands of years before their arrival.
The settlers arrived on the east coast of North America. Along the east coast, there were many different Indian tribes. They spoke many different languages. Some raised crops. Some were hunters. Some were often at war. Others were peaceful. Many of these tribes still exist. Indian nations like the Seneca, the Mohawk, the Seminole, and the Cherokee. Indian tribes shared a highly developed system of trade. They traded goods over a wide area. The first recorded meetings between Europeans and the Indians of the East Coast took place in the 1500s. Fishermen from France and the Basque area of Spain crossed the Atlantic Ocean. They hunted for whales along the east coast of North America. They set up camps and often traded with the local Indians. The Europeans often paid Indians to work for them. Both groups found this relationship to be successful. On several occasions, different groups of fishermen tried to establish a permanent settlement on the coast. The severe winters, however, made it impossible, so the camps were only temporary. The first permanent European settlers in New England began arriving in 1620. They wanted to live in peace with the Indians. They needed to trade with them for food. The settlers also knew that because they were so few in number, a battle with the Indians would result in their own quick defeat. Yet, problems began almost immediately. Perhaps the most serious was the difference in the way that the Indians and the Europeans thought about land. This difference created problems that would not be solved during the next several hundred years. Owning land was extremely important to the European settlers. In England and most other countries, land meant wealth. Owning large amounts of land meant that a person had great wealth and political power. Many of the settlers who came to North America could never have owned land back home in Europe. They were too poor, and they belonged to religious minorities. When they arrived in the New World, they discovered that no one seemed to own the huge amounts of land. Companies in England needed to find people willing to settle in North America. So they offered land to anyone who would take the chance of crossing the Atlantic. For many, it was a dream come true. It was a way to improve their lives. The land gave the European settlers a chance to become wealthy and powerful. On the other hand, the Indians believed that no one could own land. They believed, however, that anyone could use it. Anyone who wanted to live on a piece of land and grow crops could do so. The American Indians lived with nature. They understood the land and the environment. They did not try to change it. They might grow crops in an area for a few years. Then they would move on. They would allow the land on which they had farmed to become wild again. They might hunt on one area of land for some time, but again they would move on. They hunted only what they could eat, so populations of animals could continue to increase. The Indians understood nature and were at peace with it. The first Europeans to settle in the New England area of the Northeast wanted land. The Indians did not fear them. There were not many settlers, and there was enough land for everyone to use and plant crops. It was easy to live together. The Indians helped the settlers by teaching them how to plant crops and survive on the land. But the Indians did not understand that the settlers were going to keep the land. This idea was foreign to the Indians. To them, it was like trying to own the air or the clouds. As the years passed, more and more settlers arrived and took more and more land. They cut down trees. They built fences to keep people and animals out. They demanded that the Indians stay off their land. Another problem between the settlers and the Indians involved religion. The settlers in New England thought Christianity was the one true faith, and that all people should believe in it. They soon learned that the Indians were satisfied with their own spiritual beliefs and were not interested in changing them. As a result, many settlers came to believe that the Native Americans could not be trusted because they were not Christians. They began to fear the Indians and think of them as evil. The European settlers failed to understand that the Indians were an extremely spiritual people with a strong belief in unseen powers. The Indians lived very close to nature. They believed that all things in the universe depend on each other. All native tribes had ceremonies that honored a creator of nature. They recognized the creator's work in their everyday lives. Other events also led to serious problems between the Native Americans and the newcomers. One problem was disease. For example, some of the settlers carried the bacteria that caused smallpox, although they themselves did not get sick. Smallpox had caused deadly epidemics in Europe, but it was unknown to the Indians. Their immune systems had developed no protection against the disease. It killed whole tribes. and smallpox was only one disease brought from Europe. There were others that also infected the Indians. The first meetings between settlers and Native Americans would follow the same course in almost every European settlement along the East Coast. The two groups would meet as friends. They would begin by trading for food and other goods. In time, however, something would happen to cause a crisis. Perhaps a settler would demand that an Indian stay off the settler's land. Perhaps someone was killed. Fear would replace friendship. One side or the other would react to what they believed was an attack. A good example of this was the conflict known as King Philip's War. Metacom, also known as Metacomet, was a leader of the Wampanoag tribe. He was the son of Chief Massasoit. Without the help of Massasoit and his tribe, the first European settlers in the northernmost colonies might not have survived their first winter. The Wampanoag Indians provided them with food. They taught the settlers how to plant corn and other crops. The two groups were very friendly for several years. Massasoit and his court attended the first harvest feast, which became known as Thanksgiving. As the years passed, however, fear and mistrust replaced friendliness. Metacom's brother died of a European disease. Metacom, who was known to the English as King Philip, blamed the colonists. He also saw how the increasing numbers of settlers were changing the land. He believed they were destroying it. One small crisis after another finally led to the killing of a Christian Indian who lived with the settlers. The settlers retaliated by killing three Indians. King Philip's War quickly followed. It began in 1675 and continued for almost 2 years. Men, women, and children on both sides were killed. Historians say as many as 3,000 Native Americans died in the violence. More than 600 settlers are believed to have been killed. Historians say the tribe of Indians called the Narragansett were innocent victims of King Philip's War. The Narragansett were not involved in the war. They did not support one group or the other. However, the settlers had come to fear all Indians and killed almost all the members of the Narragansett tribe. This fear and the failure to compromise were not unusual. They would strongly influence relations between the European settlers and the American Indians in all areas of the new country.
These clashes of cultures would continue as more and more Europeans arrived. The Puritans from England landed in Massachusetts. The Dutch settled what would become New York State. And the Quakers, unwelcomed in England, settled in Pennsylvania. That will be our report tomorrow on The Making of a Nation. And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for more stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.